Welcome to the intersection of theater and even more theater. You have achieved stage grok. Stage Grok, the roaming theater podcast, coming to you from the geographic center of the American Theater. I'm your host, Scott Miller. Today, I'm talking with Amanda Green, Broadway lyricist and composer, about the musical High Fidelity.
Okay, well, thank you for talking to me today, Amanda. I want to focus on High Fidelity, and as you know, I am freakishly in love with your show.
Oh, thank you so much, Scott. Yes, you are a huge fan, and you've done so many great things with it. Really grateful.
Well, so first, I guess I want to start at the very beginning. How did you come to the idea of adapting Hi-Fi?
Tom Kitt had the idea. He had been we were at the BMI Musical Theater Writing Workshop together.
Nice.
And he volunteered to be my musical director at that point. We really didn't know each other that well, but he said, "You're funny, I'd love to play for you sometime." And the first time he played for me, like, we rehearsed this song once, and he came to the gig without, and he was like, "Oh, no, I know it." And I'm like, "God, who's this guy?"
That's wild.
And he was like, "Hey, we should try writing together sometime." And he came to me with the idea. And, you know, it took me a little while, but also, you know, I was seeing how talented he was and amazing. And I got to write with him. And High Fidelity is my favorite, top five favorite novel. So I was really excited by the idea. And I did think, like, will it make a good musical? And then I was like, well, here's the first song, you know. So
right.
I jumped at it from that.
So you did have some hesitation about, will this work?
Not hesitation. I mean, you always have to ask yourself that,
right.
You know,
right.
I can't say I had a huge amount of course, I got a theatrical family, but I had written a 1:45 beforehand. So it wasn't like I was an old hand.
So Hi-Fi was your first full length?
I think it was. Yes.
Wow.
Yes.
Okay. All right. So Tom comes to the two of you decide, yes, this is worth pursuing. How do you start the process? Had you already read the novel?
I had already.
Okay.
I really well.
Yeah.
The first thing we did was try to figure out who the rights.
Oh, right.
Nick Hornby, and with the film, but with the rights to what. And there were not that regularity there was today, so that there weren't a lot of sit to find out. So it took us a while to find out that actually Disney owned the rights to touch the film.
Oh, wow.
And what year
are we talking about here?
2011.
Okay. All right.
And it took us like another 6 months to get to, we figured out we had with Tom Schumacher, who was Disney.
Right.
And we got advice from various people about you should write some spec. So we wrote two or three songs on spec, in the Desert Island Top Five Breakups, that song that we wrote. And then we had a friend who was a friend with Tom Schumacher, and he helped us get a meeting, and we wrote a pitch, and was very helpful. And then we met with Tom Schumacher, and we played him a couple of songs, and Rick Ellis.
Who's one of the guys who wrote Jersey Boys, right?
That's right. That's
yeah,
right.
Okay.
And they said, yeah, we'll give you a chance. Yeah, sure. So that was, we were so excited.
Nice.
Yeah.
Okay, well,
it
seems to me the most important choice you made was that every song would be in the voice of one of Rob's rock gods. Was that an early decision?
I am that. It was one of the first, it wasn't one of the earliest songs we wrote. But that's not true. One of the earliest songs we wrote is Ready to Settle as well.
Which
and,
is awesome.
thank you. Because we had our first impulse was to write a school number for the breakups. And that was originally going to be
wow.
a number that that he had with Sarah, the girl who in our musicals now, simply known as the girl who became a lesbian. But it was supposed
right.
to be about each song, each breakup was going to have its song. So that one.
Now, let me ask you about that. So Ready to Settle, which we now think of as the Indigo Girls song in High Fidelity. Was that intentional at the beginning?
Yes.
That was the Indigo Girls song? Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
yeah, Tom said, and I was like, oh, okay, that really helped us, you know. Set the style and the tone for sure.
And I have to tell you, when we first started working on it with New Line, I emailed Tom and said, you know, obviously you're invoking all these different rock artists. You know, are there specific songs that, you know, were inspiration or whatever for the songs in the score? And I think it was like within a half an hour, he emailed me back this list of like 15 or 20 songs that were, you know, kind of, I think, vague models, but still models for the pieces
absolutely.
In hi-fi. And it really helped us in understanding exactly the sound we were going for in each song.
Yeah, we definitely, you know, we brought each other things and said, what about this and what about that? Yeah.
And I also have to inject, one of my favorites that we got said that Goodbye and Good Luck was the best Springsteen song that Springsteen never wrote.
Yes.
Which I just thought was so amazing. And it was such a validation of the concept of how you were telling the story.
Absolutely. Tom is, you know, a Springsteen fanatic. You know, I had to do my, I mean, I like Springsteen, but I had to do my homework. But he was like, this was the chance of a lifetime. Loved all the physical section of that song.
All right. Well, so talk about then when David Lindsay Abaire came in.
When David came in, it was definitely that point. Because as I said, we were writing songs and performing them in cabarets, Tom and I, our friends, to sing them. And that got us. So they were coming down to hear us, and people got all. But then David came.
Now, before this, were you planning to write the book, or you just hadn't thought about it yet?
I hadn't written the book to a musical, and I was thinking about it, but you know, I was writing good dialogue, but structuring it is not. I was new to that.
Yeah, that's always been my problem when I'm writing. I can write great dialogue and jokes and punchlines. I can't structure.
Right, in terms of structuring. Yeah, like the first time we did first act was in a half, you know. and we loved, you know, it was the biggest thing that had to go was that each girl got, each breakup girl had
right.
her own music, because that was adding an extra 15, 20-minute first act, you know.
But I would also say now, knowing the finished product, that was a wrong turn, because they are not the point of it, right?
Exactly. That was something, that was a learning process. Yes, no,
right.
I don't, I mean, we had great songs. You know, some of them, a couple of very sorry to say, of telling.
And also, I think that's connected to, I remember both New York reviews and a couple of reviews here in St. Louis complained that Laura wasn't on stage enough, or that she was underwritten or whatever. And I think it's because they were perceiving this to be a romantic comedy. But it's not. It's a story about Rob and coming of age, findings and so forth, right?
Right. Yes. And it was, it was about a year and a half ago, and we wrote 5 different songs for one moment for Laura in the show. And they're wonderful songs, and they
right.
kept coming and going, and it was all for the moment when he's leaving him at the
right.
top of the show. And it eventually was replaced by a scene. Because, again, as you said, it's not a romantic comedy. It all of a sudden
right.
had this great opening number, and then this sad or pointed or funny and angry or
yeah.
wistful or, you know, we wrote every single kind of song you could think of for that moment, and sort of weighing it.
Right.
They
and
all,
so the lesson was
songs.
The lesson was we can't come up with the right song for this moment, because there shouldn't be a song.
Maybe
here.
It's not the maybe, yes. And then, of course, you know, Too Tired.
Which we had asked you if we could put back in the show.
Yes.
And you guys said, we're not sure about it, but if you want to, you know, put it where you want to put it and record it and let us hear it, da-da-da. Okay, so we did that, and then you and Tom came back and said, sorry, we really don't think it belongs there. And it wasn't until later in our process that I realized how right you were, because we shouldn't give Laura a huge amount of weight there. That's Rob's moment. That's where he's figuring everything out.
Right. Yes. Yeah. It's hard. Again, when you're writing a show you love, but that's no.
How early did you come up with Last Real Record Store on Earth?
That was probably, I have to credit Walter Bobby with that. It's like, we didn't have an opening with Desert Island Top 5 Break.
Right.
We gotta have an opening number, you know? So it was like a year or so into the process, and it took a long time to, you know, it took a long time to come up with the hook, and, you know, that was something we talked about a lot. And once we came up with many parts and that
yeah.
writing and rewriting.
Okay, well, so let's stop and talk about Last Real Record Store. So I honestly think it's one of the best opening numbers in any musical anywhere. I really think that. And part of it is because it's just unbelievably awesome pop. You know, like, it's just like a great song.
Very pop.
But on top of that, we meet all the important characters. We introduce all the important themes, including a lot of things that we don't yet realize are the themes of the show. Like, you know, that opening number really deals with the kind of stagnation that is the kind of the point of the problem of the show.
Right.
There's just so much going on in there, and yet it's also really funny and super high energy, and it just seems to me like it accomplishes everything dramatically you have to accomplish, and it's great music and great lyrics, and it's a great song. And I just think that, you know, I don't think a musical always accomplishes all that stuff in the opening, and I think it's really cool when it does.
Thank you. Although at one point, I kind of bossed it. We almost cut it. It was cut.
Wow.
I know, it was cut for like 3 or 4 days, and then, you know, put back one, put back another. Can we just put the whole thing back now?
Yeah. Well, because what it also, all those pieces, what they also do is introduce this idea of referencing all these different rock artists.
Absolutely.
Because
yeah,
you reference a bunch of them in the opening.
Yeah, yeah.
All right, well, so now talk about how, because I think when people adapt films into stage musicals, particularly, I think they often make a huge misstep in that they take the screenplay and stick songs into it, which doesn't work because they're different storytelling forms. So talk about how you adapted the novel and the film into this very different storytelling form, particularly because Rob's addressing the audience and we've got the whole device of all the rock star songs and everything. So how did you kind of come up with how does this show work?
You know, we all had this, but it evolved. The book was kind of our touchstone, loved, but the movie was very helpful as well. I mean, you know, actually, and so
right.
that was the jumping off point, goodbye and good luck. And it evolved. And then the more and more as we were writing it and as it evolved, we would go back when ideas were failing us and we didn't know how to solve a problem, we would go back to the book, you know, and that sort of became our Bible. Not that we would follow it directly, but when we were like, what needs expressed, what's happening here?
How early did you decide that Rob would be our narrator?
It always seemed that way in the book, so I don't think that was pretty...
And one of the things I loved about it, too, was that he was not always a reliable narrator, which I think is always so interesting in a show, because we think we can always trust the narrator.
Absolutely. Yeah, David Lindsay Bear did a great job with that. You know, but wait, you know, right, of making him pointed and reliable.
Yeah. Which is both funny, but also surprising and keeps us engaged and so forth and so on.
Exactly, exactly. To get away from it.
Okay, so now talk about the starting to put it on its feet. Did you do workshops, readings, et cetera?
We did a reading, 9-hour reading, and it went very well. And then we went right to work. So it did not have the...
Did you do any rewrites in between?
Oh, many. Many,
okay.
Yes. Yeah, rewrites happened all the way, and
okay.
We did rewrites, and then we rehearsal, and we did a couple of, I guess we did like a reading at the end of the rehearsal for an audience, or, you know, an invited audience, and then we, at that thing, you know, cut whatever the latest Laura number was, you know, we cut right before then, and then we went to Boston, and we'd written another Laura song for that moment, you know, so there were many Laura songs coming and going, and
it's kind of like
Boston,
Bobby's Big Song and Company, it just took a while to find it.
Exactly. And we couldn't figure out what happened at the end because it was like too tired with the anchor. We'd written that a while ago. And then we took a song for Rob and that we opened with in Boston for that Happy
With. Why weren't you happy with it?
It was another moment, expanded-y, this love song, the two of them. And it was almost it had the sort of the same things about we're all flawed, we're all
right.
But we have this wonderful love. And it was a little too kind of cheesy, actually.
Yeah.
It wasn't meant to bear that much weight. It was supposed to be sort of
right.
a song that somebody was in a club that being something on top of, you know. So it didn't quite fit the bill. It wasn't there of Rob or
right.
Although it was a new song, you know, lots of people didn't feel right. And then that was the last song we wrote. Which,
oh, what a beautiful song.
Oh, Tom wrote a gorgeous. It was really, really funny because he wrote me to figure out what the song was about. And he said, well, I wrote this melody. And I was like, yeah, but we don't, you know, just write a melody the song is about. So thanks. But when we figure out what the song is about, then I'll write the lyrics and you'll write the music. And then like 2 days before, like we had to play for the, give me that music again. And I was like, well, he was right. That was the perfect music.
So generally through the process, did you write lyrics first?
No, not all the time. Generally the process, though, we would say like, okay, here's what the song is called and it's about, you know,
right,
kind of thing. We had an idea of
did
what
you
the song
ever
was.
Write in the same room?
Oh, yeah, a
yeah.
lot. Yeah. But it generally, what we would say in the same room, come up with the idea, maybe a few chorus here, but to know what we're writing about, come to gate progress.
Right. Okay, so this may be the painful part. So it opens on Broadway, and the critics are just awful about it. What is that like to write your first big show and it opens on Broadway, especially after your parents both had worked, and then the critics are like, no, we hate this. What's that like?
What do you think it was like? It was terrible. It was terrible. What else could it be like?
Did the producers immediately say, we can't run this?
Yeah, it lasted a very short time. You know, I mean, I think quarterbacked or by
right.
now it's Wednesday. But yeah, no, it was, of course, it was it was our first show. It was a long, exciting process. It was very
and I assume a total surprise, right?
Absolutely. I mean, I was naive in a way that, like, the signs were not, like, good. You know, I mean, it was like, yeah, sales were not good, things, and the Boston
no.
reviews weren't very good. And but we had worked and worked and worked, and so I was shocked, and yeah.
And part of what I found so weird was so many people were angry before the fact that you were going to open a High Fidelity musical. Like, they were just so offended by the very idea of it. And I kept thinking, I don't understand this. Why wouldn't it be a musical? It's an entire story about music.
Yeah, no, I don't. I mean, I think it's just so many play. I mean, I think the pop music snobs didn't like Broadway, the Broadway
yeah.
of High Fidelity. Broadway people didn't like, you know, what is this stuff with them? Why do we care about them? You know, I mean, so it sort of fell between the cracks, but it certainly...
Okay, so it closes relatively quickly. And did you just assume that it was dead? Did you think it would have more productions?
You know, I didn't have any fall back on it. I certainly didn't have a rosy future.
Yeah.
So yeah, I didn't have other examples. So people, oh, it's going to be done. Don't worry, you'll get a life. You know, but it wasn't. It did not have a future at that point.
Well,
I know from talking
to artistic directors of regional theaters that for the most part they're not going to pick up a show that ran in New York but got bad reviews. Like, that's
mm-hmm.
poison to them, which is unfortunate, but there it is.
Absolutely. I mean, I do think enough times passed that it matter. You know,
yeah.
It's definitely not like the next, the last bomb. You know,
yeah.
we've got it.
Well, so how
hated
come
it
you...
in New York? See how you like it here, you know.
How come you did get a cast album?
I think that was something the producers thought was important, made it happen.
Well, I'm glad you did.
Yeah, me too.
That's how
me
I
too.
Found.
Absolutely. That's if you don't have a cast out that.
Yeah, I found a lot of shows.
Yeah.
Okay, well, so now here's the weird part. So then we produced your show, and you came to see us. And
yes.
So maybe this is a loaded question, but what was that like? Coming to see the show that you thought maybe was dead, and now here are these people out in St. Louis that are going to put it up, and you're going to come see what it's like. What was that experience like?
Well, it was a wonderful experience. It was great to see it, and that wasn't so personally loaded for me. You know, I mean, it was,
yeah.
the pressure was off me. You know,
right.
So just so from that point of view, and it was great to laugh, and you know, I told you, an incredible Rob. So it was it was nice to see that it could work with different casts. You know, because I loved our New York cast,
yeah.
and a small band on stage. I really loved the home, you know, the homegrown feel and the way that no big sets in and out. You know, it was just great to see that it could work pared down and to, you know, to people laugh and have an audience. And, you know, it was so loaded and fraught when it happened, done, made sense of. You know, it would have been a bummer to see it and be like, wow, they really didn't understand it. And,
right.
you know, once again, you know, poor misunderstood High Fidelity. But So it was terrific, and it was a real balm, B-A-L-M, and, you know, I was so happy to report back to Tom and David, and I shared the room, and they were so happy. You know, it was a really nice, you know, silver lining, sure.
Well, and it did great for us. I think it sold out every show, and the reviews were amazing.
It's amazing. You did a great production.
But it's such a smart, incredibly well-crafted theater, and particularly when we were working on it, we were all just baffled by the just ugly reception it had gotten.
Yeah, no, I was too, because I knew, thank you, first of all, but yeah, I knew that we had not written sloppy, you know, uninspired
right
show, you know, so that was always, you know, whether it, the music snobs didn't like it or the Broadway's, whatever, people didn't like, I mean, I did that, so.
Yeah.
Yeah, great.
Yeah.
And
now there are
completely. Yes, go ahead.
now there are productions happening. I've seen online colleges, small companies like us. People are starting to do it now.
Absolutely. We're talking to Young UK.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, I'm really excited about that. Yeah. So I really do think it have a life and deserves to have a life, but I give credit you in the map.
Well, I have to tell you, Jeff Wright and I talk about this quite a bit. Last Will Record Store on Earth is, you know, not only can I intellectually admire it, but I love it so much.
Aww.
And I will often be, I'll be listening to
Tell
Cass Elman.
Yeah.
I'll be listening to Cass Elman in the car, and I will play Last Will Record Store like 6 or 7 times in a row until I've blown out my voice singing at the top of my range and the top of my lungs. But there's just something so unbelievably infectious and fun about that opening number. And I think it's maybe that magic stuff that you can't really quantify, but it's just awesome, and I love it very much.
Well, thank you.
So you've done some shows since then, and I assume you have some projects coming up.
I do. I'm writing with Richard Thomas, a New Line fan, who wrote Jerry Springer.
Oh, right.
Together.
Oh, that's so awesome.
I know. I adore him. And so we're having a really good time doing that. And then I'm working on a project, some very fancy people, but really fun. And I'm working on a tea drama. So there you go. That's
nice.
Thinking.
Nice.
Yeah, so things are good. Yeah.
Well, so your dad, the legendary
Adolph
Green, he didn't get to see anything of yours produced.
He only got to perform and Broadway.
Okay. Oh, well, that's cool.
Yeah. How
very proud. Crazy proud would he be of you now? This is so awesome.
Oh, he would be very proud. He was supportive and proud, Papa.
Very cool. Well, thank you so much. As you know, we are in love with Hi-Fi here, and
well, do it
I just
again.
Thought, well, you know, we've done it twice now. But there are a few shows we've done 3 times, so Hi-Fi may come back again. But I've told Jeff Wright I'll never do it without him.
Nor should him. Okay.
Well, thank you very much for talking to me.
My pleasure, Scott. Anytime.
Thank you for joining us. This is Scott Miller. Now you, too, have achieved stage grok. See you next time.